Hello. Good morning. And welcome to The Agenda, a news and current affairs and culture show from the perspective of those of an underrepresented gender. My name is Sophie, taking the reins today, and I'm super excited to be here with you all. Lots of chats and tunes coming up over the next hour, so I hope you'll stick around. Big love to Tom for the last 2 hours of On The Record. Some excellent chats and tracks there. If you missed any part of On The Record today, be sure to restream the entire episode on our website at rtrfm.com.au, or you can cherry pick your favourite stories, which will be up later today. Coming up on the agenda this morning, we are going to be chatting to Dr. David Riley about gender and one's estimation of IQ. We'll also listen to a conversation RTRFM's Danielle Raphael had earlier with Dr. Ross Hollett, looking into how certain eye-gazing behaviour has found that looking at people's bodies rather than their faces is linked with harmful attitudes towards sexual assault. If you want to reach out to me at any time, please send me an SMS on 0405 921 921, or email me at studio@rtrfm.com.au. Depending on who you are, when asked to estimate your own intelligence, most people will say that they are, you know, above average, even though that's not statistically possible. In fact, overestimation is a normal cognitive bias and extends to any social trait, such as, you know, honesty or maybe how good your driving is. But in a recent study, Dr. David Riley and colleagues explored how consistently men and women estimated their own intelligence, or IQ, and he found some interesting differences. Dr. Riley joins us now on the agenda to explain more. Welcome. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Hello, Sophie.
Look, Dr. Riley, I'm not entirely sure what IQ is. Would you be able to define it for our listeners?
Okay, so IQ is measured by an intelligence test, and it stands for an intellectual quotient. It's basically how bright and smart you are on a range of different cognitive tasks. So things like your verbal ability, your vocabulary, your problem-solving skills, your reasoning. But what it doesn't measure, though, is practical intelligence. So things like your emotional intelligence, your perceptive abilities. And so it's only measuring a very narrow subset of what the everyday person would call intelligence.
Right. And are there any other sort of misconceptions generally that people have about IQ? Not just, you know, participants in this study that you conducted, but perhaps in the wider community?
Well, in the wider community, there's a lot of gender stereotypes about ability. So, for example, that math is, you know, more of a male thing, or that some people still, you know, despite all the evidence to the contrary, still believe that males are a little bit smarter and a little bit brighter than females. That's one of the things that we found in our results. Males overestimated their intelligence to a large degree, but females actually underestimated it. And the consequences of that occupationally, professionally, even personally, can actually be really harmful.
Absolutely. I found it really interesting that those who had predominantly or, I guess, perceived masculine traits also had, you know, higher estimations and things like that. And obviously we're talking in quite binary terms here, but what were some other main factors in people's estimations?
So another factor was people's level of self-esteem. Mm. So if you see yourself as, you know, a good person, you're basically decent, you're a nice person, you have value, then you rated your intelligence way, way higher than someone who self-doubts themselves and doesn't see their own value. Now, unfortunately, there are gender differences in self-esteem. So women generally tend to have lower self-esteem, And so that also explains some of the gender differences that we found.
We are chatting to researcher at the School of Applied Psychology, Griffith University, Dr. David Riley, about how gender factors into estimations of intelligence. Well, why do, then, you talk about sort of self-esteem and things like that, but why do men typically see themselves as so much brighter while, you know, women and other genders consistently underestimate their intelligence? Are there other things, you know, beyond self-esteem? Are there other intersections and things like that?
Yes, so there's definitely cultural factors that are going on. One of the things that previous studies have looked at is gender stereotypes about intelligence. Now, most people would agree that males and females are equivalent, but when we ask parents to rate the IQ of their or intelligence of their child, sons are actually rated as smarter than daughters. Even if you control for the age of the child and the maturity level, it's a fairly consistent pattern and it happens cross-culturally. So even though overt gender stereotypes about intelligence are fairly weak, we have these implicit associations of males being brighter, smarter. And that sends a really harmful message to young girls. If their own parents, their teachers, the people around them don't see them as intellectually capable, and they internalise that message from a very young age. You know, parental expectations really do determine academic achievement, and it sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So one of the things that we're so passionate about with this research is that we get the message out there that males and females are equivalent in intelligence. There is no smarter sex, but that we're consistently undervaluing the intellectual capabilities of young girls, and they're consistently undervaluing their own abilities.
Well, how do we start to change these perceptions, you know, within ourselves? How do we, you know, begin to combat that internalized, you know, say misogyny or anything like that? But yeah, how do we start to change these perceptions?
So I think parents can certainly provide education or enrichment activities for their children, taking them to a science museum. Don't just take your sons, take your daughters. Teachers can also play a role here. So one of the beliefs that people have is that intelligence is fixed, it's hereditary. And we know that that's not true. You can actually improve your intelligence with consistent effort and enrichment activities and environmental stimulation. So teaching children that their intellectual abilities are not fixed, that they can actually improve with effort and with practice, that's actually, it's called a growth mindset. When we teach children this, it changes their perceptions about their own intellect and it gives them a greater aspiration. And so, you know, all children could benefit from that knowledge, but particularly girls who feel that they may be lacking in some area, maybe in math or science, that they can actually improve over time. And that knowledge is very, very powerful.
So it's really about, you know, fighting these biases while we're young and making sure we're nurturing, you know, all the things that we can do to fight these perceptions.
Yes, and being aware that these gender stereotypes actually have no validity, that in itself is also helpful. So, you know, we need to be a little bit more open and talk about it, and make sure that young girls in particular feel valued and that they're intellectually capable and that they can compete just as well with the boys.
Dr. David Riley, thank you so much for chatting to us on The Agenda.
Thank you, Sophie.
That there was Griffith University researcher at the School of Applied Psychology, Dr. David Riley, chatting to us about how gender influences one's estimation of their own intelligence. If you missed that chat, you can restream it on the RTRFM website. Just head to the shows tab, go to the agenda, and you'll be able to find a link to restream today's show, as well as a playlist for all the music. And you should be able to find this chat by itself in your podcast feed, as some chats are, you know, put out to the world through the podcast realm. And we're going to talk about a new study looking into what's called eye gazing behaviour, which has found that looking at people's bodies rather than their faces is linked with harmful attitudes towards sexual violence. This study, led by psychology researcher Dr. Ross Hollett from School of Arts and Humanities at ECU, used eye tracking technology and self-report measures to examine how men and women look at the opposite sex. Dr. Ross chatted to RTRFM's Danielle Raphael to find out more.
If the following story raises any issues for you, you can contact 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732 or Lifeline on 13 11 14.
We set out to basically try to understand men and women's gaze behaviour. So in doing that, we used a couple of different methods. One was to ask people directly using questionnaire items, how they looked at men and women, and we also use eye tracking technology as well. So we presented some of our participants with images of men and women, either partially or fully dressed, and we directly measured their gaze behaviour. So one of the things that we were primarily interested in was people's preference to look at bodies instead of faces, because that's something that we know to be a potential marker of attitudes which are potentially undesirable, such as attitudes related to sexual assault. And in doing this measurement, we did actually find some interesting correlations between people's self-reported gaze behaviour and their actual gaze behaviour and their sexual assault attitudes. And that was true for both men and women, actually. There was correlations for both men and women in terms of their gaze behaviour. But probably the one that's most, I guess, relevant because of the nature of the questions that we asked was the fact that men who gazed at women's bodies more, particularly women who were partially dressed, we're more likely to endorse ideas that women have a greater tolerance or might invite sexual assault, basically.
And the question that comes up for me is, were people aware that they were doing this, or is this something that is kind of ingrained and subconscious?
Well, of course, in the context of getting ethics approval for a research study, we have to be quite explicit about a lot of the measurements that we're taking. We're not clear exactly what we're looking for. We don't disclose that information to people, but we do give them a general idea of the nature of the measurements that we're using. One of the advantages of using eye tracking is it's tapping into an actual behaviour, something that is quite automatic. And the images were presented very briefly. So, you know, we had quite a few different images, but they were presented for only around 4 seconds each. So you really are taking advantage of people's automatic gaze patterns, which, you know, we can control our gaze to some degree, but those initial presentations of stimuli, people tend to, you know, they tend to go with their gut, and there's like an automatic inclination that we're able to take advantage of. So I think as far as the gaze behaviour goes, that's one advantage. With measuring people's attitudes, you know, that's a challenging one because some of these attitudes are not particularly socially desirable. But the fact that we did manage to get some of these, you know, reasonable strength correlations, at least by psychological standards, suggests that there is some meaning in these associations.
Sure. You mentioned the eye tracking technology, but I know that you also use self-reporting.
That's right.
Yeah. How does that work?
So we actually set out to create a new questionnaire. So we basically created a whole bunch of items about 40 or 50 items, and we distilled it down to best quality ones to develop a couple of different measures. One of those measures was the extent to which people engage in body biased gaze behaviour. So this is really quite uninhibited, intentional behaviour that involves looking at people's bodies. And then we also asked them questions about the extent to which they try and attract attention to their own bodies. So we labelled these scales as pervasive body gaze and provocative body gaze. So there's sort of an assumption that, you know, people not only look at bodies, but they also engage in behaviours to try and draw attention to their own bodies as well.
And it's also, I guess, just tagging along from that, important to recognise in terms of the research that this is dealing with the binary men and women and heterosexual relationships. Correct. It's obviously it's hard to predict or make assumptions in terms of other genders, but can you glean anything in terms of the perceptions of, say, trans women or other underrepresented genders?
Yeah, look, as you say, not really, not from this research. Mm. I mean, this research, even what we've done here with heterosexuals, with quite a substantial sample size compared to previous studies, is, you know, a pretty decent achievement. And one of the things I always say to people is, you know, until we understand, you know, the vast majority, it's going to be hard for us to answer questions about more minority groups. Mm. And very dedicated research efforts would be needed for that. I mean, this took us 5 years to get this study completely right. finished. It was a lot of effort just to get that many heterosexual participants to, you know, participate in these procedures. So I suspect that, you know, as the door opens for people to do research in this area, so obviously eye tracking technology and obviously the use of our new questionnaire, we're hoping that that will actually allow people to start looking at some of those minority groups and helping them to do research and understand them better as well.
Sure. You mentioned at the start that, you know, eye gaze and things such as looking at someone, all these kind of behaviours that may seem benign actually contribute to a larger discussion around assault and specifically sexual assault. What prompted this research specifically?
Well, there has been a couple of studies done already that have been starting to link gaze behaviour with people's attitudes. And we did one a few years ago on actually looking at video game characters. And through some of that research, we discovered that there were some interesting patterns of correlation there. But a lot of it's quite theoretical in the sense that, you know, gazing at people's bodies is a sign that you're evaluating that aspect of a person as opposed to, for instance, their emotions or social signals, which are typically communicated through facial expressions. The other thing that's worth pointing out here is we're not talking about, you know, the occasional glance at someone's body. We're talking about, you know, gaze that is outweighing attention towards other areas. So it's probably quite an obvious behaviour. So, you know, you can usually tell if you're having a conversation with someone and they're not obviously giving you eye contact, and it's not so much they're looking at, away from you, but they might be looking at other areas of you, and that's often a sign that perhaps they've got some particular attitudes or some intentions or motivations that may not necessarily be innocent. But of course, you know, we've only got correlational data on that, so we can't make any causal claims. But there's definitely some evidence to suggest that we could make some arguments in that direction.
Yeah, and it is slightly, it's quite unnerving, that finding. Why is this, I guess, leading on from that problematic?
Well, it's, you know, it's, as I've pointed out, it's kind of it's a bit of a two-way street. So we have to recognise that, you know, gaze is sometimes innocent and potentially also is a marker of less innocent attitude. So I think we always have to be mindful about how we talk about these behaviours, and also it's about having the right tools as well. So, you know, part of what the research is trying to achieve is actually just develop a better understanding. But I think the other important thing about gaze behaviour is it's actually quite an important communication strategy. So I think we use gaze quite deliberately at times, and other times we're a little bit automatic and unintentional with it. So, you know, one of the things that we were interested in this study is, you know, to what extent are people aware of their gaze? So we had self-report instruments, and, you know, they actually, the self-report and the direct measurement using eye tracking were reasonably well correlated, suggesting that people do have a pretty good sense of their gaze behaviour. But, you know, we looked at things like comparing single and partnered people as well to see if there were gaze differences and how they behave as a way of sort of understanding whether gaze might be used as a social signal or a communication in situations where people might have sexual interests, for instance.
Right. So I guess this kind of boils down to attitudes, which I mentioned in the study, specifically sexual objectification and how that kind of plays out for different genders. What needs to be done to break down these attitudes? The kind of the impetus for a lot of this behaviour is, I guess, the socialisation behind it. So what can be done to do that? What has the research shown?
Yeah, look, I mean, that's the million-dollar question is how do we potentially, I guess, avoid or reduce the likelihood that people would adopt certain attitudes. But I mean, one of the things that I tend to focus on in my research is looking at the influence of media exposure, so certain types of media, particularly early in life, and the potential that people are being sort of socialised or normalised to certain ways of dressing or looking at people or behaving. And that type of media can help to, I guess, create attitudes which are problematic for people's sexual interests and behaviours and things like that later on, potentially. But then also there's the sort of protective factors that we have to think about too. So, you know, that media is going to be there either way and people are going to be exposed to it in some form. So it's sometimes about developing those protective attitudes or behaviours or ways of thinking that kind of work against the ones that can get us into trouble.
If the material covered in this story raised any issues for you, you can contact 1800 RESPECT on 1800 737 732 or Lifeline on 13 11 14.
That there in that conversation was RTRFM's Danielle Raphael chatting to Dr. Ross Hollett from School of Arts and Humanities at ECU about the links between how we view bodies and attitudes to sexual violence. And like the warning there said, if that story raised anything for you, I urge you to contact 1-800-RESPECT, which is the National Sexual Assault Hotline, or Lifeline at 13 11 14. If you'd like to listen back to that chat, you can do so at rtrfm.com.au, and you can also find all the other conversations that we've had today. We had a chat earlier to Dr. David Riley about how gender impacts your perception, or your self-perception, rather, of your own intelligence.